In this session, we're going to be talking about shaping the will. This is a critical time in a child's life when we're endeavoring to shape the will without crushing the spirit of that individual. This is the reason we set aside an entire session to talk about this area of shaping the will. There are dangers implied in what I've been saying in the earlier teaching about discipline, particularly of the strong-willed child. There are those who would be very easy to discipline and would go along and would not be difficult at all. But then there are others that we run the risk of literally damaging the spirit or the self-concept or the self-worth, and knowing the value that we ought to put on the self-worth of a child, I'm particularly concerned that I don't leave the wrong thoughts with you about disciplining. I'm very concerned that you might think that I'd recommend a harsh, rigid approach toward discipline in the home. But I don't feel like that's the way it ought to go. I have known and have read and have seen situations where children have been abused and have been wounded. I feel like they need buckets of love and all kinds of tenderness every day in their lives. One of the most difficult parts of the teaching to get across to parents is the necessity of a balanced environment in the home between this discipline and love at the same time. No subject distresses me more than the thoughts of child abuse. In a study that Polly and I have been making, of course, we've read many books evolving around training children and disciplining children and shaping the will of the child. And so much that we've read has been alarming. It's been an exciting study. And it's been going on for a long time. And just realizing the hurts that many boys and girls have gone through because of abusive parents. Let me ask you a question, and let me say again at the same time that I believe that this kind of inflexible discipline, this harsh touch that so often is the pattern of people in disciplining their children, that it's dangerous. It's dangerous for us, and particularly as Christians, because we're not only just interested in that child making it through life, but we're deeply concerned that that child meets the Lord and follows Him and is an obedient Christian for the rest of his life. The adult-centered home of yesterday was, of course, I think, a real danger, because then everything evolved around the parent, and they were kind of the masters, and the children were the slaves. Now then, we live in an environment where the total activity generally centers around the child, and the parent is the slave. I cannot believe that this is God's plan. I don't believe that a master-slave relationship, whether it's between the children slave to the parent or the parent slave to the children, is God's plan. I believe there is a balance, and I think present-day truth, I believe the Lord is saying to the church today, there is a balance in our life today. A lifetime of unhappiness can be avoided if the twig is bent so the tree will neither lean to the left nor the right, but will have the proper direction and the proper shape that God intended. But how is this done? How do we shape the strong will of the child without breaking the spirit of that same individual? Let's talk about the will for a few moments. The child's will is a powerful force in the human personality. In fact, I suppose that it's one of the most powerful forces. It is one of the few intellectual components which arrive full strength at the moment the child is born. In a recent issue of Psychology Today, this heading described the findings from a study of infancy. A baby knows who he is before he has the language to tell us so. Psalms 139, I think, says it as clear as anybody has ever said it. Verses 13 through 16 in the Living Bible says, you made all the delicate inner parts of my body and knit them together in my mother's womb. Thank you for making me so wonderfully complex. It's amazing to think about. Your workmanship is marvelous, and how well I know it. You were there while I was being formed in utter seclusion. You saw me before I was born and scheduled each day of my life before I began to breathe. Every day was recorded in your book. I have the feeling from a thorough study of this scripture that much more of our lifestyle is already framed and formed before we're born than we have ever given thought. A toddler can become so angry that he is literally capable of holding his breath until he loses his consciousness. One headstrong three-year-old refused to always obey his mom by saying, "Don't forget, Mom, you're just my mommy." Assuming that moms are not all that important and that they often are a threat to what boys and girls want to do with their own life. The will is not delicate or wobbly. It's often a will of steel. It's fixed. And it's often a threat to the individual and to others around him. But the spirit relates to self-esteem or to the personal worth that one feels about themselves. It's the most fragile and tender of all characteristics in the human nature. And nothing is more easily wounded or more vulnerable to rejection and ridicule and failure than the spirit. But how do we shape the will without damaging the spirit? First of all, I think, and I've said it several times, but we need to establish some reasonable boundaries and enforce them with love. But by avoiding any implication that the child is unwanted, oh, that's a big one, or unnecessary, or foolish. None of our words, none of our intents, none of our attitudes, none of our actions should ever suggest to a child that they are unwanted, or that they are foolish, or they're unattractive, or that they're unnecessary, or that we didn't ask for them. By the same token, they didn't ask for us either. So it's vitally important that we protect this area. We may refer to them as ugly, dumb, or a burden, or an embarrassment, or a disaster, or I've even heard them say in recent months that they were a mistake. The damaging effect of these words upon the child, who may already be struggling in the area of the self-worth, even in a lifetime, they probably will not fully recover. The cost is great. What about the disciplinary actions and influences and the behavior of our children? It's these actions and not an angry parent that will accomplish the task that's so vital. Adult anger produces a destructive kind of disrespect in the mind of our children. They perceive that our frustration is caused by our inability to control the situation. How foolish this game is, where mom and dad use empty threats and stay mad all the time. How much better it is to use action and get action with the child. When your youngster discovers there is no threat behind the millions of words he hears, he stops listening to them. Most parents, even those who are very permissive, have a point beyond which they will not be pushed. And of course, children know exactly where that point is in our lives. We adults reveal our particular points of action in many ways. Often, the only time that the child's middle name is ever used, when we include the middle name, well, it's a tip off to the child that we're angry. You know, Byron Scott Rowe, that means you're in trouble. So often, we give tip-offs to the child that we are angry. Our speech becomes more stern and abrupt. Young man, I told you. You know, we really begin to accent the words. Then our faces turn red. Dead giveaway that we're angry, that we're out of control, that we're frustrated. We jump from our chairs, often scream. Johnny knows it's time to cooperate. He'll obey immediately then, right in the nick of time, just to avoid the punishment. We decide, of course, when he responds like this, that anger was the key. So the next time, in order to control our child, we become angry. We thought he responded to the anger. Little did we know that our response was something he's been looking for as a key, that he's gone as far as he can go. However, our anger is nothing more than a tip-off. A tip-off that we are frustrated enough at that moment to spank his pink bottom. And he's been wondering when that was going to happen for a long time. You do not need anger to control a child. You do need action. Would you put on the overhead, darling, action versus anger? Anger is not the approach. Action is always the approach. You can apply the action anywhere on the timeline you wish. Baby, would you just kind of put a line across the overhead projector there? Now, every parent has a timeline in which they will discipline their child. And they know where the timeline's at. But the child also knows. He knows if that'll be a third of the way over, halfway over, three-fourths of the way over, 98% of the way to the end of the line, or if it'll be at the total end of the line. Now, the sooner we respond and the shorter our timeline of action is, the quicker the response. And then the less frustration is involved. Your child will live within the boundaries, regardless of where you set them. He'll live there. You let him push you to the end of the timeline of action, he'll do that day after day after day. But let me say again that the closer the action is to the timeline or to the beginning of the act that requires discipline, the better it will be, the better mood you'll be in. See, it's when we become angry that we become abusive or harsh or we become tough and wound our children or do things or say things that not always easy to correct. So don't hesitate to move quickly. Make the timeline very short. That does not mean you're intolerant. There again, we're talking about in discipline that we only do that when they willfully defy your authority. Dad draws his line much sooner than mom. And the reason for that is because mom's a feeling person. And as a result, she is more tolerant and more lenient toward that. Now, there may be days, if she's already experiencing a lot of stress, that she may respond quicker because her timeline may have been shortened by other things that have already happened, or it may be from actions of a previous day or a week ahead. And so she's waiting until the proper time when she says, I've had enough, this is it. But Dad's timelines generally are shorter than the mother's timeline. A dad of a five-year-old daughter heard her say to her little sister who was doing something wrong, I'm going to tell Mommy. No, I'm going to tell Daddy. He's worse. And that is exactly the truth in most all cases. Parents who have no action line, or else it occurs too late, does not avoid the unpleasantness of that particular situation. Some adults learn one truth easily, and some never quite grasp it at all. The delicate balance between love and control, this is the key. Recognizing that a reasonable and consistent action line does not assault the self-worth, but presents a source of security for the immature child. The strong will adolescent. Let's talk about it for a little bit. A teenager is often desperately in need of respect and dignity. Give him those gifts. The period of early adolescence is typically a painful time of life, marked by rapid change and emotional changes. Ages 13 and 14 are commonly understood to be the most difficult 24 months of an individual's life, a time when self-doubt and feelings of inferiority, you feel less than other people, reach an all-time high in the lives. The second group of people in the world that experience such feelings of inferiority are the very old people. First, the 13 and 14, and then your grandmas and grandpas are experiencing right now the same kind of shattering feelings that the teenager feels. The feeling of insecurity, of the lack of worth, the lack of real importance, the lack of existence and reason for being in the world today. And it's one of the reasons of early death, simply because they do feel useless and helpless and of no real value to anybody today. The impact of having no one to sit with on a school trip, the impact of having nobody invite you to an important event, the impact of not being selected on a basketball team, any kind of athletics, sports, events, this can be so devastating to the self-worth of the child and can destroy. Or being laughed at by somebody else, maybe someone of his or her peers. These are things that almost will never be forgotten. I dare say when you're twice the age or three times the age some of you are today, that you'll still remember the way somebody laughed at you, the way somebody cut you down, the way somebody made you feel less than you really were at that particular time. This period of time has also been identified as the most destructive years of life and are probably the most critical to the development of a child's mental health. It is during this period of self-doubt that the personality is often assaulted and damaged beyond repair. When this happens in a child's life, that child may actually turn to a whole new lifestyle. It may be, and often has happened, that children have gone so far from a life pattern that they otherwise live because of some traumatic event that took place in their life that literally destroyed the last of the self-worth they actually had and possessed in their life. Junior high students are typically brutal to one another, attacking, slashing, particularly the weaker vessels in the school. It's such a damaging and such a dangerous age. The task then, of course, of prying open the communication doors between moms and dads in this teenage group, this group in particularly in junior high, when these doors have been closed, and it often is difficult and sometimes almost unable to open those doors of communication. Reasoning and communication. The older your child grows, the more you will be able to reason with him and help him and train him to become the man or woman of God you want them to be. Communication, of course, is a prerequisite for preventing problems with our sons and daughters. This is the reason we say that communication has got to be the number one problem between parent and children. If there is regular communication, if there's regular time to communicate, then the lifestyle will be built together. Discussions of misbehavior is inevitable. It must happen. It must take place. So many times, and of late, I've heard it said by moms and dads to a child, if you get in trouble, don't come running to me. I heard a mother say those words a few weeks ago. I could not believe I was hearing those words. I later said, to whom will the child go if you close the doors? Who will they turn to? My wife has got to be the greatest mother in the world. I believe that. And I'm sure you can appreciate the validity of that statement. Polly was able, all through the years of time when our girls were still at home, and to this day, has been able to maintain such an insight into their lives, such a compatibility, such an understanding for them. Of course, part of Polly's education was directed at being able to understand adolescents in school. This was one of the specialized subjects that she took. But I think beyond that, and I give far more credit to Polly's ability to understand than the training that she received. But all through the years, I've been hearing both of our girls say that Polly is their very best friend. And our oldest daughter and youngest daughter still make plans to come home and do regularly. But when they come home, they always say, are we going to get to be alone? Is it going to be just us? Will we have time to ride the horses? Will we have time to go shopping? Will we have time to go saining? My youngest daughter, some time ago, said, I want to come home, and Dad, one of the things I want to be sure we get to do is to go saining in the creek like we did when I was a little girl. And so when she came home, well, I got up in the top of one of the storage rooms of the house, and I found a seine that we had seined with when she was a little girl. It was pretty torn, and it had a lot of holes in it, but she sewed it up, and we went to the creek to seine just like we used to. That relationship that has remained through the years is a great factor in establishing strong bonds in the home. When moms and dads, you know, I believe I've heard Polly say many times, and I've said it, listen, I don't want you girls to go wrong. I don't want you to miss the mark. I don't want you to get involved in drugs and sex and alcohol. I don't want that. But if you ever do, would you let me be the first one to know about it? But how many parents have said, don't come here drunk, or don't come here with your dope? Listen, you and I must leave the doors open in our homes for them to always have a place of refuge, a place of shelter, and always be sure you have left wide the doors. Does not mean that you accept what they're doing. Does not mean you approve of what they're doing. And this is the area that I think most people have more trouble understanding than anything else, is the fact that they say, how can I accept him when he is involved in blah, 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 drugs, alcohol, sex? See, the difference in accepting him or her and their action is two different things altogether. We said for years, I've heard it said many times, we hate sin. We hate sin. But I literally believe the time came we also hated sinners. That's dangerous. We need to be able to identify the child from the actions and love the child and reassure them. The same thing with parents. I may be talking to someone here today, maybe a husband, maybe a wife, and maybe right now there's conflicts in the home. Let me tell you how to resolve them. The conflicts will basically be resolved when your mate knows you totally accept them. But somebody comes immediately and says, how can I accept him? He's doing this or she's doing that. Not saying accept that. You're saying accept them as a person. The margin is thin between the two. But be sure they know you accept them. Be sure they know you love them more than anything else in the world. You cannot say too often to your son or daughter, you will never know. Only God will ever help you know how much I really love you and how much I appreciate the opportunity God has given me to raise you. Boy, how they need to hear those words over and over again in their life. The way you communicate with them is so important. The way you communicate with them. I think, how many in this live audience have studied at least some transactional analysis? Could I see your hand? A few of you have. Let me talk to you just a few moments about it. I think it was so helpful in my own life as I discovered that there is a way to talk to our children and to our parents. Those of you who are here today may be having difficulty communicating with your parents. One of the things we really forgot to convey was that parents of all ages need this teaching. Because, see, there are parents who have children who are 40 years old who have never released them yet. See, you've been hearing me say in several sessions, you must release the child beginning with that early age, about 1.5 years, start releasing. But there are parents, you kind of snickered when I said that, but there are parents who have children 40 and 50 years old and older who have not released them. And some of you may still be living under some kind of guilt of a mom and dad that keeps hanging on, wants to tell you when to get up, when to go to bed, what to do, where to live your life, how to conduct your life. You're smiling at me again. See, so everybody needs to understand that there is a time when we must release and we must know how to communicate with them. Let's draw a little diagram, darling, three circles down one side of the overhead and three down the other side. And let's label them parent, adult, and child. The parent part of us, we're going to say that this is you, and we'll say your parent are you and your child, son or daughter. From the parent part of us, this literally, we are comprised of these three areas, the parent, adult, and child in us. The parent part of us is the known part of our life. This is the knowledge we have. We begin to establish and develop this area of our life. By the time we were about 10 months old, we already had some parental knowledge. We had some facts. One of them was that all you got to do is yell real loud and the lights come on. Babies learn this by the time they're 10 months old. All you do is start screaming and the lights suddenly come on, doesn't matter what hour of the day or night. They establish and deposit that knowledge. That's in the known part of them. And then, of course, the adult is the thinking part of us, the reasoning, the developing part of us, the part of us that's thinking and growing, the innovative part of our lives. And then the child part of us is the feeling part of us. Now, when we communicate out of all three levels, the known and the thinking. I sure hope we're talking out of the thinking, and also the feeling part of us. Now, a parent may, if he's not awful careful, when trying to persuade his child to do something, may appeal totally to the child's feeling or to the child's emotion. So draw us a line, darling, from the parent to the child, and you may say, if you do not mind me, I'm going to spank you. Appealing totally to the feeling part of the child. That's from the known part of you to the feeling part of the child. Most of our communication should be adult to adult. Even though the child may be 1 year old, we should be talking out of the thinking part, which is saying, if you don't mind me and go to bed and get your rest, you're going to be sick. Okay, so you're not only talking about out of the known, but you're also talking out of the feeling, out of the thinking part of you, and also out of the feeling part of you. So from that level of communication, we are truly communicating. So often, our parents today of this audience, you may have your own parent today refer to you or ask you or tell you things that totally live and direct you out of the adult, the known part, which is, yes, out of the parent, out of the knowing part of us. And it's a dangerous way to direct life. It's vitally important that we begin to communicate straight across the board, right straight across to our children from the thinking part of us, including, of course, the known and the feeling parts of our lives. Dialogue can lead a child into new areas of learning and understanding. Communication, it's vitally important. When you and your child are communicating, when he senses you're trying to understand him, he is able to perceive things more clearly. This requires sensitivity and active listening. Conversational feedback is one technique for helping our children understand our emotions. As you speak to him, restate the emotion your child is expressing. Rather than offering advice at every step, simply feed back to him what you perceive his feelings to be at that particular time. He is thus encouraged to think further until, through your gentle glances and guidance of his life, he comes to understand his problem. Restate your child's expressions. Does two things when this happens. Number one, it shows you have heard him. And in many cases, we're really not listening to our children. It also says you care. It says that you are deeply concerned about what's happening in that particular child's life at that particular time. Link behavior and desirable and undesirable consequences, dealing with the defiant child who listens but chooses to fight back. Don't be drawn into verbal battles by leaving your child into areas which are not understandable to him. Don't argue with your teens. Don't perpetually threaten him. We did say that be sure that on your action line that you're moving quickly. Don't wait a long time to take action. Don't make insulting accusations. Don't nag him endlessly. The quickest way to stop all communications between the parent and the child, or between husbands and wives, any relationship, is to continue a continual flow of nagging around the house that seems to repeat monotonous phrases that really are meaningless to the child. How then do we do it? About the only tool available are to manipulate environmental circumstances when discipline is required. Keys to family cars are tremendous in getting done what you want done. Son or daughter can use it, or they can be chauffeured. And they don't really like to be chauffeured. They much prefer to just be able to use the car. Can grant or withhold privileges to the beach, to the mountains, or to a friend's house. Has an awful good effect on children. Control the family purse. They can either share it or loan it, or they can close it. Can ground the teen. Or you can deny the use of a phone or television. There are many ways to actually begin to discipline. Then, what about preparing for adolescence? Early training can eliminate some of the pressures of our times today for our teens, we must tell our teens in advance of the problems they'll be facing in the future. Since you have already been in the place where teenagers are going today, we should never allow them to go into uncharted waters. Hold on with open hands. The most common mistake made by parents of older teenagers, 16 to 19, is in refusing to give them the independence and maturity they require. In doing so, force our young adults into one or two destructive patterns. They accept our overprotection and remain dependent children into adult life. They rise up in great wrath to reject our bondage and interference. They also may lose on both accounts and become emotional cripples and grow up into an angry, guilt-ridden adult. American parents are the world's worst when it comes to letting go. We just seem somehow or other to want to hold on to them, hold on to them. It speaks, of course, of that insecurity and our own lives. The best time to begin preparation for a child for the ultimate release that he is going to experience it one day is to begin that at an early, early age. The parent, supposing the parental purpose should be to allow more freedom and more responsibilities as the years go by, so that when he finally gets to the time of adulthood, he will no longer need the direction of the parents. Our objectives should be, as parents, to do nothing for our boys and girls which they could profitably do for themselves. That's called rescuing. We talked about it in an earlier session. It's difficult to implement this policy. Our deep love for our children makes us tremendously vulnerable to their needs. And so many times we feel like it's a lot better to do it for them than it is to have them do it for themselves. The old Chinese proverb which says, give an individual a fish and you feed him a day, or teach him to fish and you feed him for a lifetime. The same is true in our own boys and girls. We must remember not to rescue them. You'll be coming to the years sometime along the way. Some of you are already close to that, when your boys and girls will be going out on their own, building their own nest, and it'll be easy for you to say, let me help you, let me provide. You know, there's a house next door in our neighborhood, same size, has all the amenities that we have. And so often parents make that mistake of moving their children into that lifestyle. I'll never forget, it was somewhere in about 1964. Polly had driven her car, it was a Cadillac, for about 4 years. It was then, it was bought when it was a 60 model. And our daughter was then old enough for her car, first car. And so I said, how would you like to have mother's car? Well, of course, that didn't sound good to her at all, even though it was a pretty sharp-looking car. But when you start a kid out in a Cadillac, where does he go from there? Same thing true about the home and in other lifestyles. See, that was poor judgment on my part. And of course we didn't do that, but I was willing to do that. It seemed like a likely approach to it, but we become so vulnerable to meeting our children's needs, and in so doing it, we often do some things that are awful hurtful to their lives. Love demands freedom. Why else did God give us a choice in the garden? Because love has no significance that knows no alternatives. It must be the product of free choice if it is to do what we intended it to do. A lesson can be learned from the prodigal son of whom Jesus spoke. He became so desperately hungry when he ran out of money that even the pig's food began to look good to him. Nevertheless, no one gave him anything to eat. There was no food stamps, no welfare checks. Nobody from home was offering. There was no unemployment. Everything seemed to be going downhill. He had already spent his life savings. He'd already spent his money and now found himself in a serious condition. Deprived of the way that he had been brought up, he decided that the best thing he could do would be go back to his father. We parents should be wise to follow the example of this loving father, always ready to welcome that son or that daughter back. He could have been standing there as he was, saying, if you come back here, you're going to have to promise to pay. You're going to have to promise to make some changes. You're going to have to promise to do a lot of things. But this father seemed more than willing to receive the son back. I think he sets the example for every parent in the whole world today. With outstretched arms, the Bible said he ran to meet him. He hugged him. He kissed him. He put shoes on his feet, put a cloak on him. He put a ring on his finger, and they celebrated by killing the fatted calf. The attitude that should be expressed, and I may be talking to a mom here today, a dad here today, that may have a child away from home. I don't know what the circumstances are. But if that be the case, open your arms to them. Welcome them to you just as Jesus welcomed you when you were away from him.